I guess the biggest joke of all is me. But I've had, as usual, real pleasure of becoming well acquainted with most of the Hollywood speakers that we have here. And again, in the true fashion of Hollywood, California, this speaker we have today is, he's just come right in line with Larry and Lou and Georgia and the rest of the folks I've met from out in that part of the country. About all I could really say without taking part of his story from him, he is a writer out in California, and he is an alcoholic, and the reason I know this is because he said so, and he acts like one. And, he's contented, he's happy, and he's alive. And and what I mean alive. And with no further ado, I'd like to present Clancy.
My name is Clancy Immisland, and I'm an alcoholic. And here, somebody left their watch. I'm happy to be here today, safe and sane and sober, because I haven't always been, and it's conceivable, I know, that I may not be again someday, and that's kind of a sad thing for me to know, but I want to remember it. Because I always, when I start to talk, I say that. Because I have seen people who have had much longer periods of sobriety than I have had, who have gradually worked themselves back out of AA, spiritually justifying each step that they took, until they were back out alone. And I have seen people whose quality of sobriety is better than I have, as far as I can ascertain. I've watched these people spiritually justify themselves back out the door to the back row and then into the street. Not always to get drunk immediately. Get along very fine for some time before they fall, before you hear about them drinking. In fact, it's kind of an interesting thing when an old-timer who hasn't been around a long time drinks. Because you see new faces at the meeting. Some of them you haven't seen before. They come crawling out of the woodwork for miles around when they hear their old buddy got drunk, because they haven't been to a meeting for 5 or 6 years themselves. They think it's about time to get back for a few days. And I want to make sure this doesn't happen to me. I have one kind of consolation here. When Alan asked me to come here, I'm sure he didn't know it. I'm sure that no one knew it about me, because I was invited to come from California and provide a little sunshine to this rather windy climate. But I have one rather strong distinction in this room, I imagine. Many of you live in Texas. Most of you, I would dare say, live in Texas or have lived in Texas. I may be the only man here who died in Texas. 10 years and 2 weeks ago, I died in a little garage in El Paso, Texas. My heart stopped, and I was clinically dead. A suicide. And fortunately, the man next door kicked open the door and got me out in the driveway and restarted my heart with artificial respiration. Got me well enough to be committed to the city psycho ward in El Paso, where they examined me for 3 weeks. When I say examine, that means through the slit in the door, you know. And they talked to me and to my wife. And they had kind of given up on me. In their investigation, they discovered that I'd had some drinking problems. And they talked to my wife about my drinking problem. And she was convinced by me by that time that drinking was not a great problem with me. And the reason I knew it, because I'd been in and out of AA for 7 years by this time. All over. In Milwaukee, in Minneapolis, Chicago, Rockford, and San Francisco. A lot of cities. Everywhere I'd lived, I'd gone to AA a little by little and left again. And she asked me if I'd ever had any psychiatric help, and she mentioned a time that we took our life savings, some thousands of dollars, for intensive psychotherapy for me. And there wasn't, it didn't seem to do any good. It seemed to intensify my depressions in Chicago. They asked about if I'd had any religious training, and she mentioned that I came from a very hidebound, strict religious education, Norwegian Lutheran Church up in northern Wisconsin, which is about as tough as you can get, and that my only reaction to the word God was to turn around and leave any time it was mentioned. After such investigation, they finally came to the realization that whatever my illness was, it could not be alleviated by returning me to the street, obviously. And so, 10 years and one day ago, on October 14th, 1956, I was committed to Big Spring State Hospital, not as an alcoholic, as a schizoid, suicidal, depressive with no prognosis of recovery, which indicates a lifetime jaunt. And I went to Big Spring, and I was there 2 weeks, and I escaped, because I felt I was smarter than they were, and I was. I got out. And it wasn't until I got out that I realized it's an escape-proof institution. They can see you running for some time after you leave. And you feel like kind of a fool in your white bathrobe out there running across. And you know, it's just a matter of time till those field glasses pick you up. Why, there goes that little Yankee son of a bitch now. And they brought me back and they gave me intensive electric shock for some time. And I was there for a long time. They knocked me out. I never tried to run again, I guarantee you. They don't give you electric shock for discipline, I'll tell you that. No hospital does. But if you're running away, they figure you're disturbed. And they sure do slow you down. So I spent a fruitful 10 and a half months in Big Spring. And when I came out of this shock, finally, as it started to wear off after I was there about 6 months, and I came to little by little. I don't remember ever coming to Texas. Last thing I remember, I was playing piano in San Francisco, and now I was somehow magically transported to the Texas Nut House. I just couldn't understand it. But there I was. But I determined to get out of that hospital, and I got out by being the best patient they ever had. Fortunately, I was had a little smarts coming back little by little. So I did one thing. If any of you have been in Big Spring State Hospital in the last 10 years, you owe one cultural thing to me. I founded the newspaper there, the one that's still running. I'm the first editor and publisher. And this, in 10 cents, gets me coffee. If I have plenty of time to wait in the coffee shop. I directed a Christmas pageant. Beautiful thing. Hello there, we are three wise men. No, Clyde, that's not right. I was not in a soft ward. I was in the violent porch of the violent ward of the violent building. I was in a hardcore ward. But somehow, as I got a little bit better, and I got moved up to the easier wards, I ran into a man named Les Ross, who was very kind and spent a lot of time talking to me. And I would talk to him about my problems. He says, you know something? He says, I think you're an alcoholic. And I said, Les, I think you're wrong. I do drink badly, but that isn't my problem. There's something wrong with me other than drinking. But he was very kind, and he allowed me to attend the AA meetings in the alcoholic ward. I was first opened there. In fact, I guess that was one of the experiments to see whether mental patients could respond to AA therapy there. And I went out to Midland, Odessa, with the group, gave little 5-minute talks, and talks I didn't believe in, but I thought would help me get out. And they did, little talks like, Hello, friends. We are visitors from the hospital, and we have found 12 wonderful steps of recovery over there in the state hospital, and we are finding a new way of living. We owe to the wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which many of you have been gracious enough to bring to our hospital and give us a new way of living. And pretty soon I was out. And I went back to El Paso, where my two old sponsors who had been working with me, or tried to work with me, and I lasted till my first birthday, which was a month away. On the night of my first birthday, because I knew I wasn't really an alcoholic, I found myself at midnight, 5 seconds before my birthday, September 22nd, 1957, standing in Juarez, holding a drink, waiting for that sweet second hand to get there. And I drank. Do you want to know something? I didn't get drunk, because I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. I had something else very sick inside of me, but it wasn't identifiable to anybody that I'd ever met. And eventually I moved to Dallas, and I went to work in an advertising agency in Dallas. I got a new start. And I brought my wife and four daughters along with me. One had just been born, after we moved, after we moved to Dallas. I worked there. In the summer of 1958, early summer, I'd lost two jobs already, and I was back to being a hunted, insane animal on the street. And I came home one weekend after spending my severance check from Friday till Monday. I was going to come in the house and just throw up a while on Monday morning to get my strength back and see what town I should go to next. And my wife had moved out. When I say my wife had moved out and taken the kids, I don't mean that she moved out and took a few of her personal things. There wasn't even a rug left in the house. Just nothing. A big house, empty. And they moved somewhere where I could never contact them again. I didn't know what direction. And so I hitchhiked to Wichita Falls because a guy I knew was there, and he locked me in a hotel room in Wichita Falls with a bottle and a typewriter, and I wrote a whole newspaper to help defeat the Elephant Butte bond issue, whatever that was. I didn't know what that about, but they gave me the facts, and I typed and drank. They gave me $100, which I used to get to El Paso and call up my two old kindly sponsors and curse them and denounce them as phony hypocrites and drunk. I was thrown in jail, and I hitchhiked out of there, and I got to Phoenix, as far as Phoenix, where I was back in jail again. And a man, I didn't know a man within hundreds of miles, except the vice president of the Valley National Bank, who some years before he and I had spoken at an advertising convention, so I called him up. He came down, bailed me out, and he took one look at me and gave me $2 and said not to bother him again. And I decided to go to Seattle. No particular reason, just a new part of the country. I hadn't been in that Seattle. I got to Los Angeles, and I couldn't get out of that damn town. I just couldn't get out of that town. I had a terrible time. I was out to the AA club, hustling a couple dollars here and a couple dollars there. And I was one of the first inhabitants of Synanon. When it first opened, it was for alcoholics and narcotics addicts, and I was in there. I was back down on Skid Row, and the sad thing is I didn't even care. I didn't even have any underwear left. I had my shirt and my pants. My shirt was rather covered with vomit, and I was dirty. And I didn't have any front teeth because I had lost them playing ball in college, but I also got my bridge kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank. And I didn't much care, because whatever my problem was, it wasn't anything identifiable. And so on Halloween morning, 1958, I stood outside of an all-night theater on Skid Row. I don't know if you've ever been to all-night theaters on Skid Row. They wake you up at 5 in the morning. It's always before any decent time. Okay, hit the street. And you go out, it isn't a matter of being particularly physically sick, but you hit that cold, it's never colder and darker than when you just woke up in a theater and you're out. You stand in the street, I stood in front of this theater thinking, you know, I cannot think of one person in the world whom I can call, write, or contact who will answer me, who will say hello even, to say nothing of helping me. I have lost my 4 children for all time, which is all right. It's a break for them and my wife. I have nothing. My father hasn't spoken to me for 8 years. My mother hasn't spoken to me for 8 years. I have no friends anywhere. The ones I have, I've abused. I have at least 9 sponsors in various cities in AA, each of whom I abused terribly. And here I stand alone, and there's no help for me. And whatever my problem is, there's nothing anywhere that can help. I have tried it all. I tried Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried Alcoholics Anonymous in conjunction with psychotherapy. I tried Alcoholics Anonymous in conjunction with medications, some to pull me down when I was nervous, some to pull me up when I was in depressions. I tried Alcoholics Anonymous in conjunction with philosophy, with Nietzsche and Kant and Spengler at one time. I tried Alcoholics Anonymous in conjunction with religions, mine, my wife's. At one time I took instructions in her church three different times and was thrown out of instruction class three different times for being a smart ass. I took instructions, not formal instructions, but I studied Zen. I studied fringe religions that meet on back porches but incense burning. And there's no way for me to go because I was a hunted, insane animal. And that's why I find it rather strange and heart-tugging to me to be standing at this podium or standing upright anywhere saying that in 2 weeks on Halloween, it will be my 8th birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have not had a drink nor a pill in the last 8 years, and I owe it exclusively to Alcoholics Anonymous. Not Alcoholics Anonymous in conjunction with Therapy X or together with Fringe Religion Y or Medication Z or Better Way of America, chapters 30, 36. But this same old corny stuff that wasn't enough for me when I started going to AA in 1949, and I got sicker after that. My experience in AA was not very pleasant, you know. It's kind of upside down, you know. Usually the AA story is that you go to jail and you have troubles, and then you come to AA and it straightens out. In my hometown, I went to AA. They came to me because I was feeling very dismayed. I'd been in jail twice already, and this was a bad thing in a small town where everybody knows you. My father was a teacher and a pillar of the church. My grandfather was an elder in the church, and I was that, well, there's that, you know. By the time AA called on me, I felt as though I was permanently sullied because I'd been in jail twice. After coming to AA, however, I went to jail 32 times. After coming to AA, I went to a veterans hospital on a self-commitment. I went to the Big Spring State Hospital on an involuntary commitment. I lost everything I had. It shows you how the program works if you don't help. I've always admired the stories in which when people came to AA, they knew they were home. In 1958, on Halloween morning, I did not know I was home. The only reason I was around was going to try to hold out a couple days to maybe I could hustle one of these AAs to get a little score to get out of town. Because I knew whatever was going on didn't work for me. Because first and foremost, I knew I was not really an alcoholic. Not really. I could act like an alcoholic. I could talk like an alcoholic. I got to be a professional newcomer in just being an alcoholic. But deep in my stomach, I knew I was not really an alcoholic because of two basic facts. One, alcohol was not my problem. Alcohol was the only answer I ever found to my problem. My problem was more grievous at times sober than when I was drunk. Because when I was drunk, at least I was partially sedated. The sharp corners were softening up. And I kind of felt envy for people who only had problems. They got sober. They were wonderful guys who danced down the road of happy destiny, spreading rosebuds. Now I'm sober. Not me, baby. If someone would have asked me at that time to identify a typical alcoholic, to the best of my knowledge, going back over 9 years of meetings all over the country, I would have said, I don't know if I ever heard this talk, but it seems like I did. It's always some jolly, rosy-cheek old foof standing at the podium and saying, "Friends, I drank around the clock 10/5 a day for 55 years. And then one day I came through that door and the desire to drink left me instantly. And I haven't had a bad thought since the spring of 1936. And I have $5 million on me. I have a number of cars. 3 different families have returned. And I owe it all to one thing. I keep the plug in the jug. And I was certainly glad to see that there were people to whom this happened. But not to me. It didn't happen to me. It seemed like it happened for a while, but then it always dissolved. It's like building a castle out of sand to get my hopes up again that somehow it was going to be different, because it always wound up the same. I was not a man enough to be an AA. I was not a man enough to live in that jungle out there with those tigers. I could talk AA as good as anybody inside this meeting hall, but out there I didn't know what to do. They don't have any steps or any procedure posted on the light posts. I don't know what to do now. Go read the light post. It isn't that way. You don't have sponsors out there in the world. You have other tigers. You got to fight them. And pretty soon you lose and you drink and you run. Run and drink. Run and drink. And so I wouldn't want you to think, if you were new today, I've met so many people here who have been sober so many years, that it makes me feel quite humble. I know that I have considerably less years than anybody else on the program. I feel like asking, is there anyone here for their first, second, or third year of sobriety? But if some of you are newer, I would say that don't feel discouraged if a lightning bolt doesn't hit you. I've worked with a lot of people in AA since I've been sober, and I've never seen anybody who has been able to maintain a sense of belonging day in and day out from the moment they came to Alcoholics Anonymous. If we could, there would be no need for Alcoholics Anonymous. We'd all go to that first meeting, feel home, and the problem would be over. We could have just dissolved to various points of the compass. But it doesn't seem to work that way. I crawled into the back seat of an abandoned car back to the 6300 Club, the AA Club in Los Angeles, that morning, and I went to sleep till noon, till the club opened. I didn't know I'd be sleeping in the back seat of that abandoned car for the next 11 months, that would be my home, and got to be quite tolerable, as a matter of fact. After 7 months, I had a baby in the front seat. Something was happening, at any rate. And people around Los Angeles still ridicule me. They kind of say, oh, you're that nut that had that baby in the front seat of that car, aren't you? But they didn't know what an advance that was for me. This reminds me of something, and I agree with this wholeheartedly in one frame. When Jim got done giving his fine talk, and after Dick gave his fine talk last night, 2 great talks. I really think great talks. Someone leaned over and said, God bless you. I don't know how you're going to follow those 2 guys. And I don't know, I could never follow those 2 guys. And that's why I'm very glad that you don't have to compete in this organization. You're only competing against yourself. This is not vaudeville. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. Whatever Jim does next week in Bessemer, Alabama, or Dick in Ventura, California, makes no difference, because I'll be back living with Clancy Immersland on the west side of Los Angeles. And I have to live a little bit better than Clancy Immersland lived last week on the west side of Los Angeles. And it doesn't make... I cannot afford the terrible luxury of comparing my insides against their outside, because I'm lost if I fall into that race. Because I don't remember that they're comparing their insides against my outside and thinking they're losing at the same time. I must compare Clancy Immersland against Clancy Immersland. Which is why, I suppose, when I leave this conference Sunday night, I'm not going to go home. I'm going to fly to El Paso, so I can visit the little garage where I died 10 years ago. That'll help remind me I'm doing magnificently, better than I have any right to do. I'm going to call on my old sponsor, who I call up to denounce. He's been drunk for 6 years. And I'm going to see if I can't jolly him into AA to help repay what he tried to do for me. I've seen him many times, and I've seen every one of my 9 sponsors in my sobriety. I've made trips to each of them to thank them. On my birthday every year, I call them and thank them, cost me about $60 a year because we just don't say hello and goodbye. I got to tell them what's happening, and we cry and sing and holler. And damnedest outfit you ever saw. When I look at that $60 phone bill every October, I just kind of wish I'd have stayed sober in the first place. You want to know? But this is all very nice to say now I'm sober and it's well, and but I want to try to communicate to you, because it's important that I remember it, why I am here today rather than being dead in the graveyard in El Paso or being dead in Los Angeles. It's not because I'm an especially magic man, nor a good man, nor I'm still not big enough to fight the battle out there after I leave the meetings. There's no way I can do it. It's something else. I learned something in this organization that has saved my life again and again. Primarily, it is this, that I died with a preconception of alcoholism in my mind that was stronger than the knowledge of what alcoholism really was that everyone was trying to show me. There are certain things about AA I knew that I suppose everybody knows, even before you come to AA or you know after your first meeting. First of all, everybody knows that people come to AA to stop drinking. You come here to get sober. Everybody knows that. And then you come here to... You show your gratitude after you're sober by helping other people. And then you return to God. And then you live happily ever after. And it may be just a matter of semantics, but I am convinced if I still believed that, I would be dead. I would be dead. This is not the point of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nor does it ever say these things in the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that isn't the problem. First of all, for years I knew that people came to AA to get sober. And once you got sober, things got better. But that is not absolutely correct. I discovered this as a fact. I knew about it and I believed it for a couple of years. But I was sober a couple of years this time. I was director of publications for a large medical corporation on the West Coast. And I did a lot of work. I got all the at least available medical material on alcoholism from the American Medical Association. And I ran across a startling fact. You know something? It's physically impossible to stay drunk. You're going to get sober whether or not you come to AA. Nobody ever stayed drunk for 20 years. Memory may make it seem like 20 years, but it really wasn't. Nobody can stay drunk for 10 years, or 5 years, or 1 year, or 6 months. It's physically impossible to stay intoxicated because your body fights back against it. And if everybody in this room were tonight, as a result of my inspiring talk, get drunk, we would all be sober again if we never heard the words AA ever mentioned again. We would be sober again and again and again until we no longer survived. Because the problem in alcoholism, physically, is not that you cannot get the patient sober. And it isn't that you must go to a sanitarium or an institution to get sober either, because your body enforces sobriety eventually. Your body to survive fights back so strongly that you can't hold booze in. It becomes a toxic substance, a deadly substance. You hear a lot of talk about sanitariums and jails. I guarantee you get just as sober under your bed barking like a fox as you do in Big Spring State Hospital. You get just as sober crying yourself to sleep on the floor of your closet as you can anywhere. You may not stay sober, and it may be an intolerable sobriety, and you may end it soon. But you get sober. Getting sober is not the big problem. That isn't what makes alcoholism deadly. Alcoholism has been stated to be the third greatest killer in the United States. Is it because they can't get the patient sober? Not at all. They can get them sober over and over again. Sanitaria, hospitals, under your bed, jails, any number of places people get sober. This is not the problem. What makes alcoholism the second greatest cause of insanity? Is it because people like us worry a lot? Not really. Indirectly, perhaps. Alcoholic insanity is not caused by worrying. It is caused by having a sufficient level of alcohol in your blood enough times till it eats away your brain cells. That's alcoholic insanity. So if you're still worrying, you're all right. Some nights, that's all I got to hang on to. The curse of alcoholism, what makes it a deadly disease, medically speaking, what makes it an insanity-provoking disease, medically speaking, which makes it a horrible, destructive disease inside of us, and frightening and dreadful, is something much different. It's no matter how often or with what resolve the patient is lurched and forced into sobriety, eventually, the true curse of alcoholism manifests itself, the deadly curse of alcoholism. The thing that renders this different than an allergy to penicillin, which superficially is much more deadly than an allergy to alcohol, that I cannot endure the one thing that I would never associate with alcoholism. I cannot endure sobriety. This is what makes alcoholism deadly. This is what makes it insanity provoking. This is what causes people, many people, to go to their graves never even realizing that they are alcoholic, because the preconception is such, it is how you drink, not part of the pattern of drink, sober, forced into drinking, forced into sobriety, forced into drinking, boom, boom, boom. And this is the pattern of alcoholism, right to death. And the pattern gets more intense later. But you can go on your deathbed, you can say, but I'm not really an alcoholic because I get sober. When I give up drinking, it isn't better. It's them. It's something I can't even talk about. Something that I know is within me, my own personal inadequacy as a person. My fear. My self-loathing, my guilt, my hatred, my despair, my lack of any reason why I should go through anything to make such an animal as I survive. When it gets tough, it's better to drink. Because at least when I drink, I don't think about it. Never knowing that this is an integral part of alcoholism, as however many drinks I drink or how many drunk arrests I get or what I do when I'm drunk. That moment of truth at 4 o'clock in the morning when the three magic words of alcoholism pop up maybe, when you're laying off in the darkness and things are closing in, and you know you've gone through all the lip service you can, and what are the three words that drive people like me insane? Is it take a drink? That's easy to fight. Something more deeply embedded. What's the use? What's the use? God, I've tried everything I know, and what's the use? I'm just crazy. And so I came to the conclusion, fortunately, that somehow or another, in order to survive, it was not a matter of what I preconceived to be alcoholism, but my betters were able to inculcate within me when I was so desperate I could no longer think back fast enough to intercept their thoughts in midair, to discover that I have to break this pattern of alcoholism. There are two places you can break it. One, you can either find a way to drink sanely, but that's kind of hard. There's very few people who've been able to do that. Dr. Kane. I don't want you to laugh. I know Dr. Kane. He was on our television station where I was working as promotion director. I wrote some nice things about Dr. Kane. I know Dr. Kane. Dr. Kane has gone around lecturing on how you recover alcoholics to social drinking. Magnificent man. 10-year slipper. Wonderful guy. But Dr. Kane has recovered some alcoholics, and he was not averse to going on television to talk about it. Dr. Kane was supposed to be lecturing this year, but he had to put off his lecture tour. If you want to be recovered to drinking, you may have to wait till next year. Because about a year ago, one of Dr. Kane's recovered alcoholics, while on a drunk, knocked all his teeth out. So Dr. Kane has undergo some oral surgery last year, and he's still learning to lecture with his new teeth. But if you can hold out, he'll be here. There are no authoritarian statistics talking about the return to social drinking. There's a psychiatrist in Seattle who says he can do this. About 2 weeks ago, I 12-stepped one of his recoveries in Los Angeles. There seems to be no way to beat the pattern. Once you drink until you drink to excess. And I always thought that the secret mark of the alcoholic, the secret test was you take a drink and see if it sets up a craving, you know. No craving. But that is not the way the physiology of alcoholics operates. The saddest thing about alcoholism is that sometimes even the worst alcoholic can sustain controlled drinking for brief periods of time. He can sustain it for brief periods of time. And the mark of alcoholism is not that I go berserk like Dr. Jekyll turning into Mr. Hyde, my hair grows long and my fangs grow out, and I start shrieking down the street when I have had a glass of beer. But what it means is this. When I take a drink, the clock starts. Tick, 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 tick. And I will eventually drink to excess. Whether 2 days from now, 2 hours from now, or 2 months from now, I will drink to excess. The next time you see somebody in controlled drinking who you've known around AA, you look closely at their eyes, and you can just see it. You can't actually see it physically, but you can almost hear it. Tick, 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 tick. I'm handling it all right now, and I certainly appreciate everything I heard today. Eh? But I'm on the new job now, and the wife is back, and tick, 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 tick. And you can just bet your boots at 3 o'clock in the morning someday you'll hear,
I don't know what happened. I must have had a sober blackout.
You don't hear it much anymore. A few years ago, I used to hear about sober blackouts. I was walking down the street, and suddenly everything went black. When I came to, there was an empty shot glass in my hand. Oh, God. And this used to scare me until I realized nobody ever woke up with a box of See's candy in their hand. Nobody ever woke up walking to the Vespers. Always that same damn shot glass. Almost as though they were thinking about it before this terrible blackout overtook them. But that's neither here nor there. I know this. For me to drink a glass of beer, I may drink successfully for the next 3 months or the next 3 hours. But I know as sure as anything I know in the world, because I've seen it manifest itself around me time after time. My sponsor in Los Angeles who saved my life, I watched him die on the floor of a $150,000 house. When he 15 years sobriety and he went down. Because he got mad at the group he founded and stopped attending meetings and stopped working in AA. He forgot the things he was teaching. And incidentally, you might say the things you got out of AA, he didn't have any house when he came to AA, and he had a $150,000 house to die in. Now, there's a mark of progress, but it isn't quite enough. It's not quite enough to, as you're laid dying in convulsions, to be able to roll over and say, how much you say this house cost? That isn't quite enough. But I know if I drink a glass of beer today, it isn't that I'm going to get drunk, necessarily, at this moment. I may. It isn't that I'm going to run amok. But I know that sooner or later, I will be standing outside of an all-night theater at 5 in the morning with no one to care if I live or die. This, to me, is my personal symbol of alcoholism. Not being drunk, not being in jail, not being sick, not throwing up. It's feeling absolutely and eternally alone with the cold of all eternity right in your bones and no place to go. That's why I want to remember my problem is not to stop drinking, because otherwise I will get thinking that my problem has been solved because I have stopped drinking for some time now. My problem is something that is much more intricate in working with the alcoholic. I must somehow learn to live in sobriety, the one untenable area of my life. I cannot live in sobriety. I must learn to do this. It didn't come easily for me. When I was 6 months sober, I finally got a job dishwashing at the place called the Gaiety Delicatessen on Sunset Boulevard. A guy helped me get it. And at the end of 4 days, the boss called me in and said, "You're fired. We have to let you go. Here's your check." And I said, "How can you fire me?" I said, "Look, I've lost everything. I'm a fairly talented guy, and I can't do anything now. And I'm washing dishes. I'm going to meetings. I've gone to a meeting every night for 6 months at AA. And I've tried to do everything right. And I'm trying to be honest. And I'm trying to find out where my kids are so I can send them something. And I'm trying to work a spiritual program as best as I can." And he says, "Jesus, kid, I don't know about all that. You just don't wash enough goddamn dishes, that's all. You know." I accepted that like a man. I went off to commit suicide. I started to walk to the ocean to drown myself. The reason I was going to the ocean, I think, that day is because the week before on the late show at the club after the meeting, I'd watched A Star Is Born at the end of the Drunken Hero. And they're all sorry. I started to go to the ocean. I walked and walked and walked. I got to where I figured the ocean should be. And there was no ocean. I was way out in Wilshire Boulevard somewhere. I said to the gas station, I said, "Where's the ocean?" He said, "Jesus, kid, it's about 10 miles out of Wilshire. You know. And I don't mind killing myself, but I'm not going to walk 10 miles out of Wilshire Boulevard here. So that day I called up the man who was attempting to be my sponsor, and he cursed me, and he denounced me, and he said, "Listen, you punk, why don't you write a fourth step?" And I said, "Why don't you..." I forget what it was, but it had nothing to do with it. It was a mark of less than enthusiasm. My problems were I didn't know if my kids were alive or dead, and I couldn't hold a job as a dishwasher because I was inadequate. And I was a bum, and I slipped in the backseat of a car, and I haven't eaten for 2 days, and I'm sick. And I hate myself. And one thing I don't need at that juncture is to go through my mind and think of other things I've also done that screwed me up. I said, "Bob, in my judgment, I'd be better off dead." He said, "Oh, you punk." He was not very gracious to me. He didn't know how sensitive and what a... I knew how a newcomer should be treated, I'll tell you that. He said, "Listen, you punk. I don't ever hear a word again about your judgment. Your judgment has got you sleeping in the backseat of an abandoned car, and you're a failure and a loser and a sick punk. And now you want to call me with and tell me what your judgment thinks." He says, "Who cares about your rotten judgment? By God, you do it, I tell you." We had a long conversation. And at the end of that time, I was so mad at that guy that I went right back up Wilshire Boulevard as fast as I could walk and sat down on that 60 and told him, "Listen, Pepper, I go in a rabbit inventory. First time in 9.5 years, sir." And as a result of taking that inventory, friends, nothing changed. That night, I went to sleep in the back seat of an abandoned car. One half a day hungrier than I had been when I took my inventory. Without underwear, sick and discouraged. But I had one good feeling inside of me. The only way I could identify it, I certainly proved to that old fool it doesn't work. I'll tell you that. It wasn't for a month or two afterwards that I realized that feeling was not. It was something else that saved my life. And that's the way I took my fifth step on the day I was about to commit suicide. Because I was fighting desperately. Because if what the things these people said were true, then everything I was a lie, and I couldn't bear to face that, because I felt bad enough already. But I, little by little, came to learn to live in sobriety. By how? By doing things that I agreed with? Not at all. By doing things that apparently were illogical, non-applicable, had nothing to do with my specific problems. I've thought of that many, many times. In my backyard now in Los Angeles, I have a lemon tree, which has got to be one of the sick lemon trees of all time. It makes lemons that look some on this branch, look like grapes, and over here that look like bananas, and it's just, not really, but I read chapter 5 to that book, I mean to that tree, I read the Serenity Prayer to it, I kick it, and I have a terrible time. My life story would be, there's nothing wrong with the trunk, that's okay, it's that branch. And it takes a heap of falls off the stepladder before you finally say, oh, all right. And water the branch, and then when it starts to get better, you go around with your and say, I don't know how you folks can expect to be sincere unless you water the trunk the way I did. I have had to learn to water the trunk. I have had to learn to live. And then I was waiting to discover when I would return to God. This has always been a fearful prospect to me, because if I return to God, I'm wiped out. The first thing I knew, a lot of people don't know where God lives. I always knew where God lived from the time I was 2 years old. He slowly circles the spire of the Norwegian Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And he gives it to sinners. And he gives it to Catholics. And I never minded seeing the Catholics go, but I knew that I was kind of a sinner myself. And by the time you get older and you realize that your life for eternity is based on those 10 big ones on the wall, and it's kind of a shock the first time you are able to read them, you discover you've already broken 5 and you're wiped out right then. And as I got older, I realized that these were immature concepts, but there was one thing that stayed with me all my life. If God exists, I am going to hell. And you cannot live with that feeling. So you have a defense. You become perfect, but you can't do that. Or else, if you're like me, you build a defense against God. There is no God! Bourgeois myth is what it is. If there's a God, how come a busload of nuns gets hit at a railroad crossing and Frank Costello, the big international racketeer and pimp, sits with $2 million? Is this your God in action? Ridiculous. Or that other famous 3 o'clock in the morning parlor stunt. If God exists, let him strike me dead. And you develop a wall against God. But every once in a while, that something reminds you, no, I'm going to hell. I'm going to hell. That's a hard lesson to live with. And I think in AA, I was most grateful when a man pointed out to me, he said, kid, you don't have to return to God. You just got to find somebody you can trust for a while. And so the God that saved my life was a man named Bob, who lived in Pacific Palisades, California. And I clung to him as much as any man ever clung to a God. And through him, I found a slightly higher power of 3 or 4 people. And over a period of time, I found a group. And over a period of time, I found a philosophy called Alcoholics Anonymous that I believed in as a result of being driven to execute it. I didn't find it going in, I found it afterwards. And then, much to my surprise, over a period of years, you want to know something? I have never returned to God. Rather, I have done what AA instructs me to do. I have come to believe in God. For me to return to God is to return to a series of immature concepts devised by my own immature mind, and somehow I must find something more satisfying. I have come to believe in God, but I will say this, if there's any, and I could stand here for an hour and talk about my belief in God. I have not gone a day without praying for many years. Our family is the only family in our block that no matter where we are, in a restaurant or at home, we don't start a meal without saying a grace and a thanks to God. Did it the other night, one of my daughter's birthdays. People look, that they're saying grace over there at the table. And I say, screw them, baby. Because I want to live here whether they do or not. But I come to believe in God, but I want to make this my point very clear. If I would have had, in this Halloween of 1958... to find the God that I have now, I would have died because the chasm was too wide. I had to find first an arm that I could cry on and admit what a failure I was and let him guide me into a group. Not that everyone is this way, but this is the way I was. So you don't have to find the God that someone 20 years sober has found. You must find just a power slightly greater than the one you have now, in whom you can do the most significant thing that Alcoholics Anonymous asks of me, more importantly than anything, and that is this: a power in whom I can sublimate my judgment, in whom I can invest the power to help me save my life. The power to whom I can say, this is the problem, and when they give me the answer, to say, I will do it, even though I do not believe in it. Even though I do not think it is the correct answer, I will try it. And you save your life. I could very easily, as any speaker can in an AA meeting, I believe, tell you nice things that have happened 5 years after I was sober, and I'd long ago given up any hope of seeing my family again. They all moved out. So we all live in a nice little house in West Los Angeles now. The same four little girls are big girls now. And it's very happy. We have a very happy relationship. Last year we had a little son born. Keep trying, Jim. I don't find it difficult to keep trying. I rather like it. Little son named Clancy Emmislin. Again, like Jim, we got another Clancy Emmislin who is going to find something, I guess. He's going to speak here next year. And I have a nice job, I've had a nice series of jobs. I've had all sorts of wonderful things happen. And if I were at all forgetful, I might think this is kind of indicative that I have reached a plateau, friends, where I need not spend quite so much time in this addiction to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a little more time on the real things of living. Except I'll tell you something. I need Alcoholics Anonymous today much worse than I needed Alcoholics Anonymous 8 years ago. Not because my disease has progressed, but because I have had a series of complications. Each reward I've had has complicated sobriety, and I've had to learn to live with a new reward. Rewards have killed me more times than punishment ever has. If I get about two more rewards this year, I may run away. I just may run away. Not really. Because I'm a father of five children in one house, and my house is because I'm a kind of a gink, I guess. There's always AAs running into it. We've got a coffee pot this big in the living room. We haven't locked the door since we moved in there. And Jesus, I come home from work at night, I don't know which are my kids and which are my babies, you know. You want to hear Chapter 5, baby, or don't you want to see your report card? What is it? Now, which one are you? You know? It's very nice. But it requires that I must be a father. I've so much identified with what Jim said. I must be a father. I don't know how to be a father sober because many times the feeling of inadequacy has just gripped me. You're not man enough to be a father.
Yes, I am.
And especially last year I was working in television. My job was part of writing and screening commercials, and you see family situations on television where every kid in every house in the world, it seems like, is a wonderful... Here comes Daddy home from work. Quick. Fix his chair and get his slippers and get his Noxema to put on his unsightly pimples and blemishes. You know. And you see a house, you see a day full of commercials like this and you just can't wait to get home. And you go in that door and you hear, you took my brush and lost it! You did it! I gotta go to the dentist tonight! Dad. Don't you know your daddy's sensitive? The commercial I identify with is the guy that drives in the driveway sometimes and the bike is there. God bless you. Yeah. I am not the leading father in my block. But I'm a better father than I've ever been. My kids talk to me and they like me and they tell me that I'm a nice guy, which is nice. But I'm not an ideal father. I'm not a perfect husband. At all. I've been married to the same woman for almost 20 years. And people sometimes say, with your record and your background, how could you stay married all those years? It's very simple. You just Every few years, you cut out for 5 or 6 years. I have a choice of cars to drive, and I have a nice office, and I have people who respond to my slightest whim because their economics depend on it. But, you know, this is not quite enough because of one thing. I had almost the same situation when I died in El Paso, Texas, 10 years and 2 weeks ago today. Nice home, three loving children at that time, a wife, a good job, and the only thing was I didn't have a way to live in the world. And that's what I'm here to remember. I'm not at this conference to instruct you. I am here to get as much battery charge as anybody that's visiting here from anywhere. I get as much out of Dick's talk and Jim's talk and tomorrow Bob's talk as anyone here, as a credulous newcomer, because this is not truly, this is not Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a tool toward Alcoholics Anonymous. This is part of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I can read the book until I'm blue in the face, and I may get drunk. I may listen to speakers till I'm blue in the face and get drunk. I may go to meetings and talk to people and get drunk. Until I remember one thing. All of these are preparations so that I go out after this conference, I continue to live a changed pattern in the world. Alcoholics Anonymous is what I do after I leave this conference. After I go back out in the world, after I go on the job, the morning I don't want to get up because I'm tired, the time when somebody says, will you help me change my flat and I've got a new suit on, the days when somebody says, I need help, and I say, I haven't got time to help you, I want to say that. Alcoholics Anonymous is something I live alone out there after all the captains and the kings have departed and the shouting and the tumult have died. It is Clancy Immersland against Clancy Immersland in the world. So I am most glad to be here safe and sane and sober today. I go to an awful lot of meetings. I have worked with people I've never said. The only thing I've held true to is the guy, something Bob told me on the phone that day. Since I have been sober, I have never said no to an AA request, and it's caused me to move a lot of goddamn furniture, I'll tell you that. And nobody in AA ever moves from a ground floor apartment. By the time they got a ground floor apartment, they can afford movers. And I've washed dishes, and I've been hustled around. But you want to know something? I am here today, not sober, but this is something even more miraculous. Last night at 2 o'clock, I got up, I was reading, and I decided to take a walk. I was inspired by all the comradeship. I walked up and down the dark streets of Amarillo at 2 this morning. And I was thinking, just think, I have a place to go. It is cold and dark out. No different than standing outside of the Rex Theater in Los Angeles. But I have a way to go, a place to go. Not only that, but I need not fear that I meet any man. A few minutes ago, I talked to my dad. He and I are very close friends now. The reason he didn't talk to me for 8 years, because one of my little drunks, I wandered off and left my son die in his crib. And he said, you are no longer a son of mine. But now we're a very one big happy family again. I see my mother and father. I know of no person in the United States that today I cannot walk up to with my shoulders back and walk straight and say, how are you? And look them in the eye. Is this because I'm basically a good man and a fine man? Not, I'm afraid, is not such is the case. I am here because I'm a weak, fallible, mistake-prone man. I was in 1956 and I am in 1966. And this knowledge has allowed me to invest this program with the ability to save my life. It is some action I must take. You cannot take for me. I must invest in you the power to save my life. I am happy to be here today safe and sane and sober. I can think of nowhere in the world I would rather be. Because when you look at it logically, there is no possible way that a hunted, legally insane, wounded animal on the streets can 8 years ago be standing at a podium and saying, thank God that I have found God and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm a father and a husband and a respected member of my community. and I live out there in the world, and my shoulders are back, and I can look people in the eye, and I can smile, and I can say, thank God I'm an alcoholic, because until I was an alcoholic, I died from alcoholism. It wasn't until after I was dead that I discovered I was an alcoholic, and since then my life has been better than any life a clergy innocent can live. I so much appreciate the kindness Alan has shown me, and Johnny in greeting me, and George, but to all of you, I am not here to be an instructor or a celebrity speaker. I'm a hunted, crazed, wounded animal with no prognosis of recovery, being sent to an insane asylum for the rest of his life, standing here and saying, by doing certain things that didn't apply to my problems, that didn't have anything to do with my situation, it evidently watered a trunk of life that enabled me to stand here today and say, I love you all. Thank you.